So the musical Wicked.
I've decided to make you my new project.
Oh, you really don't have to do that.
I know. That's what makes me so nice.
Is suddenly popular.
Popular.
But theater nerds like
you're
me
gonna be popular.
Have known about this great show.
Get you the proper poise when you talk to boys. Little ways to flirt and glance.
For more than, 20 years or so. And people like Aaron Smith know it even better. He is a freelance trumpet player who's done some pretty big jobs, including 8 shows a week in the Pitt Orchestra for national tours of Wicked.
La, 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 la. We're gonna make you pop, you learn.
He went to school right here at Interlochen Center for the Arts, and he dropped by for a visit, so we took a few minutes to chat with him about his career. We'll hear that conversation this week on the Up North Lowdown from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Ed Ronco. We'll also hear from a U.S. Forest Service worker in Cadillac who was fired as part of broader federal job cuts. She'd been on the job for just 14 months working as a liaison with tribes. She tells us her story and how her abrupt firing has affected her life. But we are starting with a lawsuit against Benzie County. In 2022, a woman named Linda Henry was killed in her Benzie County home. The man arrested for that crime, Jeffrey Stratton, was known to authorities from previous run-ins with law enforcement, including one just hours before Henry's death. A lawsuit in federal court says that not only should sheriff's deputies have arrested the man in that earlier incident, but that a culture of misogyny contributed to their lack of action. Linda Henry's son, McCord Henry, is bringing the lawsuit against Benzie County and the deputies who responded, and he spoke with IPR's Michael Livingston.
You know, McCord, I really want to learn about your mom. You know, tell me about Linda. What was she like?
It's a big undertaking. She was a really genuine person. She was very honest, very strong, chose to be a single mother, a single parent, took a lot on and always went all the way. You know, she didn't shy away. She didn't pick the easy road. She picked the right road. And I think that instilled a lot of character in me and probably has been pivotal in dealing with everything that's happened.
I mean, she was a ranger on South Manitou, right? The South Manitou Island. Was that sort of her favorite place? Did she have other favorite parks and places to be outside?
Yeah, so we had a long history with South Manitou Island where we'd go out there and camp since the first pictures of me are like 2 on the beach having my first piece of gum. So later in life, when she got the opportunity to be a ranger South Manitou, it was like this amazing thing. And she just absolutely loved it, dove into the history, explored, met all the families that were still that had lived out there, you know, the old timers, and recorded all their stories and just did a ton of work, even outside being a ranger. So yeah, she loved all those places. But she always came back to here. This was always South Manitou Island, Leelanau County, Traverse, Petoskey, north, you know. It meant a lot to her.
At what point after her death did you begin to ask questions?
It was really pretty instantaneous for me because she called me and then I drove straight there and it was already too late. But I spent the rest of the day on the scene, and then, you know, in the middle of the night when they finally left the scene, I had to go in and button up, secure, kind of, you know, take care of things because everything was, you know, it was a crime scene and things were broken open and there's chaos. So for me, it wasn't like news that came down the line and I had to, it was happening and I was involved immediately.
The argument at the center of your lawsuit is that all of this could have been prevented, that if the suspect, Jeffrey Stratton, had been arrested when police responded to the neighborhood on a different matter just hours beforehand, your mother might still be alive. What was your first inkling that this all could have been prevented?
It just didn't make sense. You know, there was no connection. Talking to the lead state police detective. He just kind of really frankly told me that you can't prepare for this kind of crime because there's no connection. There's no, there's not a cause, there's not a disagreement or a fallout or any, there's no pathway in place. It's just totally out of the blue. So trying to put the pieces together, it just started immediately from there. And then the link to the neighborhood, to obviously the occurrences that had already happened in the neighborhood. The defendant, Stratton, was in jail. So close. He was in custody just prior. And why was he out? And why? So then you start talking to the neighbors and the victim's advocate and the prosecutor and the state police, and just these little things start showing up.
You and your lawyers obtained some records that showed deputies saying some pretty lewd things about women, and you argued that these communications show a pattern for misogyny. And I just want to know what your reaction was when you saw those communications.
Disbelief. I mean, you want to have faith in people and the systems that we count on. Like, you get through daily existence by kind of believing that things are being handled. It's just shocking. It's terrifying. It's horrifying. It's troubling. And to have it lead to my mom's murder is just, it's numbing.
What do you want to come from this lawsuit?
Change, accountability, protection, systems that are operating the way they should. Not only positively overcome this horrific murder of my mother and loss and abhorrent, like, use of authority. This is our chance. This is our chance to do something. And I don't think that can happen without accountability, financial penalty, all these things that are a part of a lawsuit.
That was McCord Henry speaking with IPR's Michael Livingston. His mother, Linda Henry, was killed 3 years ago at the age of 72. Benzie County and its Sheriff's Department did not respond to our request for comment on the lawsuit itself, but the county has said publicly that it will mount a defense in the case. Thousands of U.S. Forest Service workers have been fired in recent weeks. They are among the staffers at various federal agencies whose jobs were abruptly cut by the Trump administration in an effort to shrink the federal government and cut costs. IPR climate reporter Izzy Ross went to Cadillac to meet one of the people affected.
Marie Richards is standing in the snowy driveway outside her home in Cadillac.
Here within the boundaries, the congressional boundaries of Huron Manistee National Forest.
Really?
So your photos might pop up with a tag, if they're tagged, might say, when you were in Huron Manistee National Forest. But it's the forest is just down that road where it's actually forest property.
She's a citizen of the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians. She used to work there, too, as a repatriation and historic preservation specialist. A little over a year ago, she joined the Forest Service as a tribal relations specialist. She's having a hard time talking about her job in the past tense.
There's the congressional boundaries of any forest, and then there's actually what the forests own and manage within it. But you'll pass right by it on your way to 115. Yeah, see, I'm still doing my job, and I don't even work there. That's how much I loved it.
That change was sudden. Richards got a phone call from her supervisor on a Saturday in mid-February, telling her she'd been let go.
I
hung up the phone and I think I screamed, and my neighbor may or may not have heard me scream. I don't have the heart to ask him. I went through a lot of emotional. I called my mother and told her that I was talking to her last night about the whole, I just know it's a matter of time. It's just a matter of time until I'm gone.
Richards was one of thousands of probationary workers targeted for layoffs as part of the Trump administration's efforts to cut costs and shrink the federal government. That probationary status is part of the federal hiring process and means they were either recently hired or moved to a new position within the agency. The official notice cited Richards' performance, even though she had received a standard pay raise a month and a half earlier. She was proud of her job. She told her father she got it about a week before he died.
The thoughts that just have been running through my head since last Thursday, it's a week now, of just... none of us deserved this. We all work hard. We all work hard and we're dedicated because we're taking care of the land.
That land includes almost 1 million acres and two treaty territories. Tribal nations ceded that to the federal government, which has a responsibility to keep it in trust for indigenous peoples. As a liaison, Richards was part of that. As a tribal citizen, the work was also personal.
That was the biggest source of pride for me in doing my job was helping people understand my tribal nation's interest, Little River Band's interest, Saginaw Chippewa's interest, all the tribes that we communicate with and try to collaborate and engage in cooperative management with.
She worries about what will happen to that trust responsibility as people like her are laid off.
What does it mean career-wise, not just with the Forest Service, but what does it mean as an industry for heritage? And what does it mean for tribes with the cut in funding, the cut in services of people able to do their job? What does that mean for tribes and our tribal trust? That's a promise. That's an agreement between the federal government and tribal nations, that there are things. We have treaty rights, and without the people doing the work to take care of the land, where is that? Mm-hmm. Where is that? We have to have the public trust to also have tribal trust. Those are intertwined, that we can't have one without the other.
Richards isn't sure what's next for her. She wants to finish her dissertation about the impact of the lumber industry on Anishinaabe communities. But one thing that is certain is her desire to keep doing work with tribes and heritage.
I'm actually kind of excited about that because I love a challenge and a new opportunity. So, but it still really hurts that this dream of mine is kind of shattered, and we'll see, and find a new dream. But ultimately my career, my livelihood is in tribal relations for our heritage, and I will find a home somewhere.
That was Marie Richards talking with IPR's Izzy Ross. Richards was fired after 14 months at the U.S. Forest Service. A spokesperson with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which oversees the Forest Service, said in an email that the agency has made the difficult decision to release about 2,000 probationary employees from the Forest Service, none of whom are operational firefighters. This week, a judge blocked the firings across the federal government. As of the recording of this podcast, it was unclear what the exact implications would be for Marie Richards and other workers like her. This reporting comes to us through a partnership with Grist. The Lowdown will return in a moment.
The American bumblebee population has declined by 90% in the last two decades. People have rallied behind Save the Bee efforts, and backyard beekeeping has exploded in popularity. But what if all those colonies are making the problem worse?
This is not a species going extinct. It's a livestock animal. It's like saying the cows are in trouble.
Why raising domesticated bees, especially in cities, is probably doing more harm than good. That's next time on Points North. That episode of Points North is available now. You can listen to it wherever you're hearing this podcast.
Welcome back to The Lowdown. I'm Ed Ronco. We're going to introduce you to a trumpet player named Aaron Smith. Aaron is a freelance musician, and he does a lot. He arranges and composes music. He tours across the country. He's backed up big names like Beyonce, and he plays in Broadway musicals. He honed some of his skills as a high school student at Interlaken Arts Academy. The school's brass faculty recently commissioned a piece of music from Smith, and he came back to campus during Black History Month to talk about his career, and IPR's Izzy Ross snagged a few moments of his time.
When was the first time you picked up a trumpet, and what pushed you to continue that instrument?
The first time I picked up a trumpet was really young, probably 7 or 8. And my parents both played, well, my mom was a singer and my dad played upright bass and a bunch of different brass instruments. So I was always exposed to some sort of, you know, music in the house and recordings and people coming over and jam sessions and all that. And then one day I was watching TV and saw Wynton Marsalis on TV, famous trumpet player, doing a side-by-side. This was in the early 90s, you know, and doing a side-by-side with Lincoln Center, and I think it was Boston Pops or something like that. And just the fact that he went, did a classical jazz thing in the same set, you know, I just looked at the TV, I was like, I want to do that. And so within a week we had a really, I don't know if you quite call it a trumpet, no, it's like a $30 contraption, trumpet-like product, no, that we got from a pawn shop, you know, but it got me started.
When I think about musicians, I don't think, oh, that's an easy career choice and that's an easy life to have. Talk to me a little bit about being a musician in LA, you know, you talked about doing runs of like Wicked and Back to the Future. Can you tell me a little bit just about, you know, what your job is actually like?
Sure. Well, it's multifaceted. That's one part of my job actually is playing theater, Broadway shows in LA. It's really great, a really great job. I mean, if you're familiar with Wicked, you know, it's
what?
Yeah, what's that? What's that? The musical is both acts in a 3-hour chunk or so. And that's what I play every night. And it's that music, right? And Defying Gravity and everybody. And, you know, they have to make an announcement not to sing.
Crowd. You mean for the audience?
For the audience, yeah. The ushers have to tell them not to sing. So just to play for audiences like that, and just in general with great material that's written, it's a really a dream, but also a challenge because you know there's a lot of expectation to do your job well, and it is a job. You know, we're kind of like athletes, and 8 shows a week is not easy either. So it's you know, a commitment.
You went to Interlaken. What's it like being back? And what's it like being back on campus and talking to students, you know, working with student musicians?
Well, it was pretty trippy up front. Just the drive in, you know, and as soon as I started recognizing things, it's like just kind of blasted back to the past, you know, exported into my old psyche, I guess, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it was just kind of this electric feeling. And then I walked around and the first night and just, you know, got reacquainted of every place that I'd ever been. And so it was really great. And then just rediscovered that kind of silent power, beauty by the lake, too, you know, something really happening over there and on campus in general.
You mentioned a composition that you wrote. What was that like? You know, what did you draw on for that?
It's called Passages. The title of it is called Passages. And it's really about a passage of time through a place. And for me, when I wrote it, it was about my passage through Interlaken or a student's passage through Interlaken, right? Bringing those experiences onto paper now, played by some faculty that were here when I was here. The trombone professor, Tom Riccobono, he taught me our brass ensemble and things like that. So that was, it's pretty incredible and a meta experience, you know, a full circle kind of experience to have them play a piece written by a student for the school, you know. And then to come back here and to workshop and later present the piece, you know, it's really special. You know, I'm really grateful for the experience and hope to just pay what I can forward, you know, to whoever I'm around while I'm around.
Trumpeter Aaron Smith, talking with IPR's Izzy Ross. Smith is an alumnus of Interlaken Arts Academy and a freelance musician in Los Angeles. And now, turkeys. Highway M22 is a beautiful scenic drive around Michigan's Leelanau County. If you live here, you know that. If you don't live here, you might also know that because it is pretty famous. It winds through the village of Sutton's Bay, and if you have been through there in the last few months, you may have noticed some turkeys. Wild turkeys appeared there one day and decided to just stick around the city's downtown area. But now, the people of Sutton's Bay have had to say goodbye to the birds. IPR's Ellie Katz has more.
This is a tale of a turkey trio. Last fall, Mike Campbell stepped out into the empty lot behind his shop and saw something a little unexpected.
Obviously, you see birds and squirrels and rabbits and cats occasionally, but you walk outside and you see three turkeys standing there. That's a little bit different.
Campbell owns Murdoch's Fudge Shop in Sutton's Bay. He's the president of the local Chamber of Commerce. And he says it's not weird to see turkeys around, but
what was kind of odd is that they stayed and they didn't go anywhere. So apparently she felt like this was a good place to raise her children.
A hen showed up with two tiny babies around October, Campbell says. Once they got bigger, the trio got a little braver.
You'd see them standing in the middle of M22, stopping traffic.
One of the babies disappeared pretty early on, maybe hit by a car or snatched up by a predator. But the two remaining turkeys reached celebrity status. The village held a Facebook vote for names.
It ended up being Bailey and Sutton.
Thelma and Louise were also popular choices, two ladies with a penchant for danger.
I did notice some people had put out some corn for them and trying to help keep them off of the main road. And we all did. I've seen every business owner around the village out there in the street herding the turkeys off of the road to try and make sure that they were safe.
Inside Hive Coffee, across the street, owner Landon McDade says he had his own names.
I know, I think I called one Ruth and the other one Gladys, but then I heard rumor that they were both males. I'm not quite sure, so.
He didn't ever have to shoo the turkeys away, but they did follow him down the block once. By mid-February, there was only one turkey left, until it was presumably hit by a car sometime last week. Wild turkeys as a whole are thriving in Michigan, thanks to decades of conservation efforts. But these three in particular left their mark on the village of Sutton's Bay.
How'd you feel when you heard the last one was gone?
I don't know, kind of at peace because he's no longer lonely. Or he or she's no longer lonely looking for Ruth.
Campbell, back at the Fudge Shop, says he was sad to see them go. They broke up the daily routine and brought a welcome distraction in the wintertime.
Felt like they were mascots of the village, and as long as they were around, it was just nice having them around. Yeah, it's just like going home to your pets, whatever they might be, and just it's a feeling of warmth and comfort, security.
IPR's Ellie Katz reporting along M22 in Sutton's Bay. And that's enough out of us. We had contributions this week from Michael Livingston, Izzy Ross, and Ellie Katz. Our producer is Max Copeland. Music is by Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Ed Ronco. We leave you this week with a little more from trumpet player Aaron Smith. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.